Please join me in welcoming Noah Symbolist.
So thanks to you guys for coming along. So the first question I have is, how many of you have come to any of these other Sundays with Andy talks along the way? Okay, so a bunch. I mean, one of the things about Andy Warhol I think that's kind of interesting is that there's just been so much that is talked, so many people talk about his work in so many different ways, and I think these Sundays with Andy sort of is a reflection of that, and there's bound to be overlap, and it's kind of ironic because if Andy himself were to be asked, like he was, like what his work meant, you know, he would sort of go back to you guys and say, I don't know. Like, what do you think? You know, so if that, you know, if that's included in the whole thing, like everything that you think and me and the 12 other people that are talking about this, plus everyone else that's written about it, it's sort of this huge amount of stuff. So that it's about everything, but at the same time, like given the how casual Andy was about everything, it can be about pretty much nothing at the same time. And those kinds of paradoxes are a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about today. One thing I think that's interesting about the show as it's set up is with this painting starting it off, which essentially is, you know, does a few things that are pretty typical of Warhol. One, using a photograph of something, an icon, in this case a painting, and then repeating it again and again. So painting and photography and repetition are connected. Now the thing about repetition was that it's something that is inherent to photography that's quite different to what how we usually think about painting, right? A cultural critic in the 1930s, Walter Benjamin, talked about this thing in an essay called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And that essay was essentially like another paradox. On the one hand, he was arguing that photography allowed for this enormous potential for how images could be made, right? Like, you could have something that was a work of art and then multiply it many, many times so that it wasn't just one original thing that was in the hands of the wealthy or the powerful, people like the church or people like the kings and queens and things like that. So that was how art was traditionally thought of for basically about, 1900 years in, contemporary Western history. And then all of a sudden, photography comes along and opens the possibility of having one, two, hundreds, thousands of copies of something that everyone could have. So that no matter how much money you made, where you were born, whether you were, growing up in some place in Eastern Europe, like Andy Warhol's family, growing up in Poland, or a poor area of Pittsburgh like he grew up in, or whether you were some of the blue bloods that he hung out with on the Upper East Side later on in his career, no matter who you were, you had access to to art's potential for transformation. And in a lot of ways, artists in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s started to explore this, and Andy in a lot of ways becomes the ultimate example of that. Someone who made work that was about that sort of democratizing potential for what art could be. So let's move into the second gallery. Okay, so essentially what I'm going to try to talk about is these three walls as a way to set up some of his major concerns. You know, here when we look at this, all these photographs, which aren't necessarily his work per se, what these photographs do is they essentially map out a kind of culture that he was a part of. A culture that he was both a participant in and a producer of. And that was really a culture of celebrity. One thing that that Andy definitely wanted to do his whole life, from the beginning, is he knew that he wanted to become famous, right? He was sick as a kid, and in his room, his mother would bring him these fan magazines for movie stars, and so his world, his sort of imaginative world, became consumed by thinking about these these sort of icons of possibility, you know, someone who could become great. And that was something that he really admired and wanted to become a part of, and also to make images about, that somehow to make an image about something was to imagine something and participate in it at the same time. But this is something, the idea of celebrity intersecting with art was something that was rather new in the 1960s. I mean, we think about the art world now, you know, in terms of if anyone reads Art Forum or artforum.com, and you can sort of look at art fairs or biennials and think of this huge machine of celebrity in the way that artists like Damien Hirst or Jeff Koons, we assume them to be sort of an intersection between celebrity and the purities of art. But in the 1950s, someone like Jackson Pollock, who for the first time was in Time magazine named Jack the Dripper, later on does a photo shoot, and not long afterwards ends up basically dying, sort of being sort of self-consumed by his own exploitation in a lot of ways. Part of that was because of a kind of rupture that had existed between the way that the solitary confines of an artist existed and the way that that artist's work functioned in the public. For a long time, the artwork itself was supposed to be the mediator between the two. But Andy saw himself as something that could be a mediator between the two. And his self, not just, you know, his body, but his identity. And his identity that was defined by architecture, by the space of the factory, and also by paintings, by through the self-portraits, and by the very ideas that he started to really inspire in a lot of people. And so there are a lot of things that become quite vague in this system, right? He wasn't simply just a painter. He made films. He also started publishing a magazine called Interview. Interview magazine, which was basically what it was called, right? Interviews between artists, people having a dialogue between each other. So somehow conversation was important, not just an artist being alone in their studio having a dialogue only with the object itself, and then that object being a mediator between someone else, but conversations between artists became important, and those then were published, and that then would hopefully create a sense of community. The factory in a lot of ways was a part of that. As I was just talking about photography in relation to art in the age of mechanical reproduction, we often thought of factories as places where business occurs, right? Production of commodities to then be sold. That was the realm of capitalism and business, and that was separate from the purities of art, right? Art was transcendent in a lot of ways. And that was, you know, Walter Benjamin was mourning the possibility of the what he called the aura of a work of art disappearing, right? As much as he wanted the democratizing potential of art to sort of, you know, have art for the masses, he also realized that something in that original had something that was pure and precious that would be lost. So there was this paradox between these two things, right? Like, art suddenly had the potential to transform things, but in doing that, it also lost something. And Andy very much was trying to have both occur at the same time, to have community, to have dialogue, to have groups of people in discussion about something, to make paintings, to make films, to publish a magazine, and have all of those things exist at the same time. And those things were also connected to his own paradox, right? Like, as I mentioned before, he's someone who, you know, grew up as a, you know, the son of a poor Polish immigrant, who suddenly is hanging out with Nancy Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sting and Yoko Ono, you know, a whole group of people that weren't just of one group. It was about people moving between their groups, right? Like people who, between groups that could be defined by ethnicity, nationality, race, class, gender, all of those things disappeared. And that realm of disappearance was within celebrity. And that was something that was, you know, his 15 minutes of fame, which this show actually ends on, was something that was quite important. Now, the thing that's interesting, I think, about this show is that it's, you know, it's the late work of Andy Warhol, the last decade, and it's predicated on three things. It's predicated on Andy and his late work returns to, according to the curator, it basically returns to the materiality, the hand, the gesture, and that being some expression of his self and who he was. Second, Andy returns to religion. You know, he's sort of moved away from the craziness of the drug culture and the craziness of all of those, you know, avant-garde bohemian artist, and he returns back to the seriousness of religion. And I think that the thing to me that's a little bit odd about those two things, there was a third, oh yeah, and return to abstraction, the third serious thing, right? Religion, abstraction, and the painting with the hand. But the thing that's a little bit odd to me about all of that is that everything that Andy was about was pushing against those purities, right? He was Catholic, but he was also gay. And wasn't necessarily, you know, he to some degree hid both of them, and to some degree was very out about both of them, right? He also, like, was painting with his hand, but he knew that to be a self-conscious gesture, that it wasn't simply, you know, a pure expression of, you know, of either God and sort of the old idea of, like, the inspiration that comes down like a lightning bolt and then exits through your hand, through the viscosity of the paint and into the meaning of the object. It also wasn't his sense of the purity of his self, you know, forget about God, but just his self, the humanist approach, where from his heart and his brain there's sort of this kind of chemical reaction that does the same thing. There was something about the machine that could mediate all of that. And his hand was a machine, his body was a machine. His body, his hand, these paints that he was getting that were manufactured in a factory. It's not as if, like, he was using only pure fluids. We'll get there in a second. But, you know, these things were manufactured very much. The body was a machine. The body was a cultural construction, right? So, like, when we think about Arnold Schwarzenegger and who he is, his body is a cultural construction that he had to work very hard to attain, right? It's not something that was innate, right? And similarly, when we think about a lot of these people, the images that we look at when we see them are pictures not just of them and their identities, it's pictures of an intersection between culture and nature, between an intersection between something that is a fact of their birth, a fact of their upbringing, and a fact of the moment of the person who is taking that picture, what they saw, what they thought was important. It's a series of choices that intersect. So, I mean, to me, the one issue that I have with the idea of the show is in some ways that his last decade would somehow undo everything that was possibly important to him. You know, I mean, to me, in a lot of ways, what this stuff does is it wears, I think the final work really sort of reveals itself on its sleeve. And I mean, I think the shadow paintings are very much about that. They're about a kind of ambiguity. Are these abstractions, like if we didn't know that they were shadows, would we necessarily name them that? I mean, the paintings like this exist at a place called Dia Beacon in upstate New York because they're connected to the kind of high modernist, minimalist aesthetic and ideas of sort of cultural production in relationship to abstraction. And they're definitely high-minded in many ways, but also they are what they are. And they are what they are by being quite honest and blunt about the possibility, about the impossibility of grasping anything as a fact. The idea of something being both sort of light and dark and one defining the other is embracing the possibility of paradox. So that, like, this self-portrait of Andy Warhol is not necessarily a portrait of his face or a portrait of his head, his skin, his eyes, or a portrait of, you know, the wig that he was wearing. You know, that these aren't sort of matter-of-fact descriptions of the physical presence that was there. It's a picture of identity. It's a picture of identity just in the same way that these photographs and the accumulation of these photographs are a picture of identity. It's a picture of a cultural notion. It's not necessarily just a picture of something that was found in reality. Okay, so we're going to head off to the next gallery. Okay, so I've been told that everyone loves to talk about this group of work over here, the oxidation paintings, which is, you know, sort of in true, you know, sort of institutional form, euphemism rises to the surface. So, you know, the oxidation paintings were made by either Andy or some of his assistants, people who worked at the factory, the workers, by essentially, you know, pissing on copper, on, you know, so that there is an oxidation process. So it's like a projection of the body onto a surface, you know, quite literally. And this isn't happening on its own, you know. I mean, over there, there's these paintings that sort of are referencing Jackson Pollock, even though they were essentially a promotional vehicle. They were what Andy called the business paintings. You know, they were a promotional vehicle for a yarn manufacturer in Italy who wanted, you know, essentially someone to help him to advertise his wares. And so Andy said, "Oh, I got the greatest idea. Yarn, Jackson Pollock, we'll put it together. Boom. And you can sell some yarn. And I can sell some paintings. It's a win-win, right?" So, but Jackson Pollock also, you know, was sort of one of the first people, not just in terms of celebrity with the whole Jack the Dripper thing, but also those famous photographs that happened towards the end of his life, where he's literally sort of taking these sticks and trowels and old brushes and literally flinging paint on the surface of a canvas. You know, there were two things that were going on there. On the one hand, the critic Harold Rosenberg called them action paintings. There was a kind of existential gesture through the flinging of paint across a surface. It was an expression of one's identity. It was a subject-object relationship. I, the individual, have a willful action in the world that I will not only make but record and, you know, stand by. Right? That sense of being in the world and recording one's existence, you know, through that physical gesture, right? That gesture needed to be mediated through that action. So for Harold Rosenberg, the action of action painting was all about that kind of existential gesture. So, you know, I mean, that could also be by other means, that kind of existential gesture, that I was here. But at the same time, for Clement Greenberg, a critic who was working at the same time, this is, you know, Rosenberg and Greenberg were the two main critics of abstract expressionism in the 1950s, essentially. And for Greenberg, what was most important about abstraction was that it was the full and total realization of what painting was all about. Because the reality of painting is not the illusion of Renaissance perspective. The reality of painting is becoming honest and true about what painting really is. It's mud and oil on some cloth that's stretched over some wood. I mean, that's what it is, right? So the more honest that you can be about that, the more truthful your painting is. The more truthful you are as a human being, and the more truth exists in the content of the work itself. So, you know, if Andy's not trying to create any illusion here, I mean, ironically, this is probably one of the most Greenbergian things that he ever made, right? It's the most factual to its making. It's self-consciously flat. You know, it refers to the materials. You know, it even has a grid, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so the second form of abstraction are the Rorschach paintings, which basically frame the space, right? One down there at the end and one over here. And the Rorschach paintings do something that's quite different in terms of, like, where ideas are found. Because as much as, you know, I was just talking about the content of the work being in relationship to the self, the identity, the content of this work is very much about just the material of its making, right? But in terms of how we as viewers respond to it, they're very different. For this, we have to go back to the trace of the gesture of the artist who projected himself onto the surface. For this, we find the meaning through Rorschach tests by projecting our own sensibilities onto that surface. It's meant to be an empty cipher, something that exists there purely for our own benefit so that we can realize something about ourselves. So the truth doesn't exist in there or even on its surface. The truth exists in our reaction to it. And our reaction to it is predicated on everything that we know, everything that we are, our whole background. That is projected onto that space. So Andy simply holds up a mirror. But at the same time, what he does is he's referencing his own process. Because how is a Rorschach made? By folding something in half, doubling it, duplicating it, and making a hole. So he's making a hole out of duplication, out of replication. Somehow this thing that's made materially references what a photograph essentially is, right? Like the possibilities of reproduction. And it's something, you know, the thing about, like, the Mona Lisa, the subject of that photograph in the back, or even Andy's face over there, is that the the object, the image within the object only becomes an icon through its repetition. It's sort of the paradox of the aura, right? Again, you know, like you only know, we know the Mona Lisa because it's been reproduced hundreds of thousands of times. When you go to see the Mona Lisa, the only thing that you can see are about 300 people with the backs of their heads holding their cameras above them. And if you can get in front of them, you have the velvet ropes, and behind that you have the bulletproof glass, and then you see this little painting of some woman that nobody really knows who she is, you know, that everyone is so entranced to write about. But really, the Mona Lisa is seen when you stand back. When you see those hundreds of projections, literally of photographs, of flashes, of eyes, of ideas, the reproduction of that image is why that painting is an icon. Just like the icons that Andy grew up with, right? The icons that Andy grew up with in this sort of Byzantine Orthodox church, where, you know, he would see Saint Sebastian or Saint Gregory or whatever. But it's not as if those saints were painted just once from life. And we had that one painting that we all have to like fly to go see. Churches are filled with them everywhere. And books about churches are filled with them everywhere. They're reproduced as paintings from painting to painting. And then when the technology shifted, it allowed not just the, you know, democratizing potential of art, but also the possibility of spreading Christianity itself. They're related. So, okay, over here, the third kind of abstraction is the camouflage paintings, which help us to get to the next room as well. And the camouflage paintings are slightly different, right? Because the Rorschach paintings were based on one very simple technology. Have some black ink, spread it on a surface, fold it in half, and there you have an image. This one is much more complex and much more tied to industry, and in particular the military-industrial complex, right? This camouflage is designed, predicated essentially on a system of nature, right? Like that we can find a way to reduce and abstract nature and then to create a pattern, right? So you see these repeating forms, like these green shapes are similar. So he's essentially creating a pattern just like the Mona Lisa, just like his own face. But in this sense, the pattern is predicated on a system of nature. But one thing that's a little bit different about camouflage is that from the other kinds of abstraction is that, okay, one is revealing the self, the trace of something projected onto it. The second is revealing the self of the viewer who is reflected back into it. But this, the camouflage, is a kind of abstraction that's meant to obscure. It's something that's meant to hide. And that's something that that I think is kind of interesting about these three models of abstraction, because they actually show that abstraction wasn't something that was just one thing. Right, that it wasn't Greenberg's idea of reducing something down to its purity, down to the canvas itself, or the flatness of the rectangle as a one true, pure, original form. It shows that abstraction is something that exists as a cultural icon in with a multiplicity of meanings, that it can be used at the service of war or psychology or our own functions. You know, I mean, there's many uses for what abstraction essentially can become. Okay, let's go into the next gallery.
Yeah, there's some very distinct lines in there.
Yeah, I think that's probably from the screening process. I think it's from the screening process,
okay, so
honestly. Yeah.
Like he had put in there.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah, because the screening usually. Yeah, yeah. I think it was more like an accident of the process than anything. Sure. So camouflage. Camouflage starts to have a couple of different possibilities. One of the things that Andy used in general was the idea of multiples and seriality, and we talked about how that functioned in terms of photography, but seriality was also something that was a major part of how modernism functioned as well. You could take a form, so someone like Joseph Albers, on the one hand, who's at the end of the second floor, would take a form like the square and then say, okay, well, what happens if we have a blue and yellow square together? What happens then? what happens if we have a red and orange square? What happens then? What happens if we have three different colors of violet and put that together? There was a kind of what-if experimental quality to the seriality of modernism, because it was looking at those sort of those pure forms and looking at that as a kind of like a basic language, you know, saying that you had like, okay, there are letters, there are words, there are syntactical forms, there's ways that we can take this language, and by simply rearranging it, we create an expression, just like language, right? You have like three words, you put them in three different orders, you create three different meanings. So Andy says, okay, well, I can take that basic modernist idea, that basic idea of structure and structure's relationship to expression. I'll just use something that maybe has a little bit more cultural weight than, say, a square. So he uses something like camouflage, which becomes a little bit odd, right? Like the very idea of something being hidden and being concealed being the thing that becomes kind of reinvested with different kinds of formal meanings towards a different kind of expression. But at the same time, you know, Andy would be just fine if the reason to have the, you know, the purple-gray one was because that would match the carpet or the drapes or the couch of, you know, the collector. That's cool too. You know, remember, this is Andy of the business paintings. This is, you know, capitalism not something to be, not something to compete against, but something to emulate. You know, again, like I mentioned that this exhibition, you know, was curated to emphasize physicality, religion, and abstraction, the serious things of art, the truthful things, the pure things, and God forbid that business should enter into it. Right? Because, I mean, if we all remember just in the November auctions, one of Andy's paintings, 200 $1 bills, sold for $47 million. 200 $1 bills sold for $47 million. An odd thing, right? But pretty amazing, right? Because what it really responds to is that he made a picture of the abstraction of capitalism. You know, because capitalism is not about real things. It's predicated on what Marx called surplus value. You know, because if you have, like, if you make a bowl because you're thirsty, and the water keeps running through your hands so you can drink it, you know, you use it. That has use value. If someone else has like this stone that they carved up so that they could cut their meat, and you exchange your bowl with that so you can have that, that's exchange value. But that's still about real things. But if you figure out a way to convince the person with the knife that they should actually give you 10 knives for your one bowl, that's surplus value. That's profit. That's abstraction. That's moving things away from the real. And this is something that Andy understood, right? That the only way to be an abstract artist was to truly embrace capitalism. And to embrace capitalism, we need to use its icons. Because its icons are the way that we traffic in capitalism. We don't traffic in capitalism to get back down to real things. You know, and so things like war are tied to capitalism. We change the colors of them based on the different places that we fight them. Right? So in the 60s, we knew fatigues to be green because we fought in jungles. Today, they're brown because we fight in deserts. Because one set of wars was essentially about the threat of Chinese communism. And today, it's about jihadism. Right? So we have our different ideological structures that are essentially reflected in these abstract forms. The colors like red, yellow, blue, the purity of abstraction, the colors reflect a kind of cultural status that we have today. So, you know, if Andy decides to you know, change the colors to match what some collector wants, he's participating just as much in, you know, both the way that sort of states interact with capitalism and the way that sort of pure artists interact with capitalism and abstraction. So one would think that maybe when Andy's shot in 1968 by Valerie Solanas, then in some ways that would be like a moment of the real, right? Like all of this sounds like big abstract ideas, capitalism, art, purity, like, but maybe, you know, meaning and all that, but maybe like if you have a bullet ripping through your torso, maybe that shatters all of that, right? Like maybe you finally have real feeling. You know, maybe there's something that can cut through the illusions of all of these big ideas. But I just wanted to read for you one quote of what Andy said about being shot. Andy said, oh, by the way, we have to just remember that, you know, Andy, in this is made in 1982, so it's long after he was shot. But also, like, before he was shot, Andy also made things that were connected to violence. You know, the disaster paintings, car crashes, people who were dead and hanging out of windows, the electric chairs paintings, the race riots. I mean, he was not averse to the difficult things of this world. You know, that was something that he also could somehow amazingly accomplish, right? That capitalism and profit were not averse to controversy. They could be connected. You know, that on a larger cultural scale, but here even on a personal scale, that he's going to remind everyone that he is mutilated. You know, so later we'll talk a little bit about how that might function in a martyr complex and Jesus and all that, but for the moment, Andy gets shot. He's in 1982, he's having a memory of this, and he makes a painting, like he made a number of paintings since then. So he says, "Before I was shot, I always thought that I was more than half than all there. I always suspected that I was watching TV instead of living life. People sometimes say that the way that things happen in movies is unreal, but actually it's the way that things happen in life that's unreal. The movies make emotions look so strong and real, whereas when things really do happen to you, it's like watching television. You don't feel anything. Right when I was being shot and ever since, I knew that I was watching television. The channels switch, but it's all television." So even in the moment of being shot, of being, like, literally dying and being resurrected by the, you know, this Italian specialist who comes in and literally massages, cracks open his chest, massages his heart, and brings him back to life. He's stitched up, he's living with the scars, and he makes an image of a gun, and that image of a gun is not just the history of that moment in its reality. That gun becomes about every gun. It becomes about the image of the gun that was always already there before he was shot with it. The violence that he basically participated in was predicated by everything that he knew about violence by watching TV and movies, just the same as us. I mean, I don't know if any of you have been sort of caught in a moment like that, but it feels bizarrely unreal. And maybe that reality, that unreality is the reality. Maybe that lack of what we call the real is television. Maybe that is the real of our lives. Maybe sort of a cultural construction of signs and an awareness of the way that those signs interact is reality. Maybe the advertisement for a gun is just as violent or more violent than the gun itself. Maybe sort of watching something be shot is just as much, if not more violent, than being the victim of it itself. Or maybe they're all the same. These are the questions that he raises with these things. That these things become images of ideas. Ideas that he didn't create, ideas that he took snapshots of, extracting from our daily life. Okay, next gallery. Almost done. Okay, so I just wanted us to focus on this painting as a kind of introduction into the Jesus paintings in there. So I mentioned early on that there are these kind of two paradoxes in terms of his identity. You know, Andy was brought up Catholic and actually continued to be an observant Catholic through most of his life in a way that wasn't really apparent to a lot of people who knew him through the factory and all that until after he died in terms of, you know, how he wanted to be buried in his funeral and things like that. So he was a Catholic, but at the same time, he had enormous self-consciousness about the materiality of his body. You know, he was a kind of Greenbergian in terms of his own self-image, right? Like he thought of how his body worked and how that body worked in terms of its desire. His desire to others, others' desire to him. And so when he finds this advertisement that says, be a somebody with a body. You know, this is how Andy wanted to be. I mean, Andy wanted people to desire him. Andy wanted people to like him. He wanted to be famous. He wanted to be loved. He wanted people to, like, take him and who he was. But the problem was is that he didn't feel that he had a body, right? Like, a body is not like be a somebody with a body. It's the body. And this just gives us an idea of what we're talking about. You know, just in case you didn't get it, the idea is this sort of buff, hulking guy that simultaneously sort of reflects, you know, the ultimate of, you know, American, hardworking, you know, young strapping men. You know, similar kinds of images were used in, like, Stalinist propaganda and also, like, in, you know, fascist propaganda from the late 30s and early 40s, like, be a strapping young man, have a body where the truth lies. You know, so Andy wanted all of these things. He wanted to have that body, but he didn't. So he had to create another body that was a symbol for his body. He had to create paintings. He had to make paintings that somehow were symbolic of him, his identity, and thus his body. So if people loved his paintings, if people bought them, then they loved him. If people wrote about them, then they loved him. You know, they desired him. He was a, you know, he was subject to their desire. And then we have an image of Christ on top of that, which, you know, the image of Christ is also a story about a body, right? I mean, it looks, you know, Christ's body looks different than this body, but Jesus Christ became a somebody. You know, like, he's a somebody. And he's a somebody because he also used his body to become a symbol of something else. I mean, that was the, you know, that's the narrative of the New Testament, is essentially that the body of Christ could become a symbolic association with the sins of mankind, both past and present, that somehow through transubstantiation, the body could be transformed through this thing that we ingest and later might even pee out onto some copper plates, that, you know, that somehow that, you know, that sense of the body was about a symbol. So both, strangely for Warhol, sexuality and its relationship to the body and Christianity and its relationship to the body were both predicated on the body as a symbolic thing, not a real thing. Something that was reduced just purely down to biology, to skin and bones and flesh, was missing the whole point. Because the body wasn't just about this. If it was, you wouldn't need to be a somebody, you'd just be a body. You know, like if that was enough, you could just be your body. But the idea was to aspire to something else, to transform yourself in some ways, and to get at that sense of desire towards something that was unattainable, both in terms of, like, you know, people attaining him, people attaining his pictures. So again, it's sort of this weird paradox of the aura, something that, you know, that has some kind of original possibility and something that has the possibility of disseminated everywhere and the impossibility of both. Okay, so we're just going to finish up with the Last Supper painting. Okay, so, you know, we acknowledge that that Christianity was important to Andy. We also acknowledge that community and the factory and things like dinner parties were also important to Andy. We acknowledge also that, like, the body, just like images, are more than what they seem, right? They're not just a thing in and of itself. Like, this, you know, this image of this body is not the end of the meaning of this, right? Because we know that it actually, this is an image of an image. This is a photograph of a painting from a story, right, that was retold from four perspectives that are assembled together and interpreted into various things, one called Catholicism, one called Protestantism, and also, you know, the Orthodox Church, right? So, like, and, you know, people got mad about these different interpretations. You know, there were some problems there. And so, you know, when Andy doubles this, he reminds us that these things aren't singular, right? And this is a double of a double, right? Because the first double, I mean, there are many multiple doubles, right? Like the story to the painting, or also every Last Supper painting before that, which is a motif, a Catholic motif. Again, before the technology of photography arrived, painters just simply like repainted things. And along the way, a little of invention, a little misregistration happened, right? But here he makes it explicit, right? That this one next to this one, that's just the beginning. This is the beginning of a kind of filmic narrative of the possibilities of interpretation of this one moment, right? I mean, even before the Catholic, Protestant, blah, 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 you know, I mean, this was, you know, a Passover Seder. A bunch of Jews sitting around breaking their unleavened bread, drinking wine, you know, celebrating something that wasn't necessarily agreed with in 16th century Milan, who kept its Jews in a ghetto. So there's multiple ways of responding to this. And one thing that I thought, oh, I just got to squeeze this in. This is a tangent. So the one thing about this show that I find really interesting is that recently the Jewish Museum did a show called Warhol's Jews. And during Andy's last decade, he was having trouble making some sales. And so he decided that it would be a really good idea to work with his dealer at the time, Ronald Feldman, to create portraits of 10 Jews, because Jews were big art collectors, and they'd probably buy them if there were pictures of Jews that were famous to put on their walls. And not only that, he did the paintings, and then he did the reproductions of the paintings, and the reproductions of the reproductions, so that he'd make sure that there were enough for everybody. The show was panned. Everyone hated it. They saw through the business paintings that were, you know, essentially, you know, there were paintings of people like Einstein and Freud and Martin Buber and Golda Meir. I mean, these were the people that were sort of venerated as icons. But the New York Times, for instance, you know, hated it. They thought that, oh, you're just reducing things down to commerce, and it's essentially anti-Semitic. So they recently redid, museum recently redid the exhibition. And I think it's kind of an interesting sort of side note to think about. You know, like, do we acknowledge the possibility for every image, you know, sort of possibly meaning anything? Is any image simply a record of a kind of naive action in terms of what he's doing? Or are these, or are all of these images necessarily kind of political, iconographic, willful acts? I mean, I'm ending these as questions more than, you know, because frankly, I don't think that there's a clear answer. You know, I don't think that we can sort of reduce all of Andy's work to meaning nothing or meaning anything. You know, or meaning, or, you know, or him just being reduced down to someone who is essentially base and selfish, or someone who was some kind of martyr genius. You know, he's none and all of these things in a lot of ways. But one thing I thought that was really interesting about this text panel is that, so Andy at the end talks about like the fact that these were hand painted. So Andy says, "I painted them all by hand." It's funny that this sort of answers the first panel in the exhibition. "I painted them all by hand. I myself, not my other workers who would like dirty this process with their otherness. This was me, primary genius, Andy Warhol. I myself. So now I've become a Sunday painter. That's why the project took so long. But I worked with a passion." So, you know, that statement to me is sort of acknowledging all of those possibilities at the same time, right? Andy is seeing himself at, you know, he's recognizing the mythology of the genius, the unitary, fundamental, you know, abstract possibility of existential expression that the painter can accomplish with the brush and paint and canvas alone, and at the same time acknowledging the possibility of a Sunday painter, the democratic possibilities of American capitalism, where art supply stores can be all across the world, where paint can be bought in tubes with a how-to kit where you can paint by numbers. We all can be painters. We don't have to just have some kind of specialized talent or gift that we're born with. You know, but at the same time, he can be an amateur, just like them, but it meant that it took a little bit longer than some. Like maybe Robert Rauschenberg, who became much more famous for making reproductions than him. You know, and at the same time that he worked with a passion, acknowledging that the passion, you know, is a code word for a couple things, right? The passion is the romantic 19th century kind of German-French notion of like what the artist is supposed to be, being purely in touch with their feeling. And at the same time, it's the passion of Christ. And at the same time, to say that they're the same thing, one that was essentially a kind of humanistic disavowal of anything that was remotely religious, the first, and then the second, the passion of Christ, which obviously was not, and him, an amateur Sunday painter, doing his best to make a buck here and there, using what he knows. Okay, that's all. Thanks.